Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2014. Lecture 10, delivered on September 22, 2014. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. Before I get to that subject, I want to share with you a few last notes on ratio analysis and financial analysis in general. And that gives me a way to slide into the topic of risk and return, chapter 7. No, we don't do chapter 6. On the board, now I'm going to use for what I'm going to say here, I'm going to use the last annual financial statements of Target Corporation and show you a few last ratios that couldn't be done with Urban Outfitters. But Target's a little bit more standard, and they got some lines like, for example, one that I want to show you here, once the screen starts to light up a little bit better, that was not available with the financials of Urban Outfitters is times interest earned. Now, times interest earned is one of the great formulas for talking about what a ratio should look like. Now, always you should look at the industry to see what the industry averages for ratios are, and that gives you a basis of comparison. The problem with doing that, well, let's try this. Sir, what would be the problem with comparing the ratios of a company with the average ratios of an industry? Is there any problem with saying, well, this company's return on assets was 14.2%, the industry's is 16.3%. Is that okay to do it, or is there a problem with that? 2% difference. Well, is there any problem? Should we say, well, this company sucks compared to the industry average? We should say that, but is there something we should say that might not be such a negative on it? There. Perhaps this is a company that's more mature, it's going to grow at a slower rate, and has a lower risk profile. You would have to look at other measures as well. Also, you might look at industry ratios, see this company, and the industry might be full of companies that are in trouble. This company is doing well, so the industry average ratios might not be too good as a comparison basis. But let me look here at Target for a second. I'm going to talk about times interest earned. Now, times interest earned is your earnings before interest and taxes over your interest expense. In other words, how many times over does the money available to pay your interest expense pay it? And in the case of Target, if I were to work that out, and I strongly encourage you to do that too, my net interest expense is one for the latest fiscal year end, February 1 of 2014, we find that the interest expense is 1,126. And we divide that by operating income, which is EBIT. They mean the same thing. Okay? So we'll do that. Oh, whoops, I want to do this the other way. By the way, here's the thing about the calculator. If you got a calculator, look up in the top right-hand corner. If there's a button that says no, then you've got your calculator upside down. What do I have to do? Do I have to do a song routine here too? Okay, 4229, 4229 divided by 1126. Did I? net interest expense, EBI, oh, you're right, 422, wait. Earnings before interest and income taxes is 4229, right? And interest expense is 1126. Am I seeing that right?
And then below that is earnings before income taxes.
No, I don't want that.
Well, that's what you said before.
I did. Earnings before interest and taxes. Whew. I thought I said income. I said income, God. Okay, I'll correct that on the podcast if I find it. No, it's earnings before interest and taxes, 4229, divided by the interest expense, 1126. And you will come up with a number, 3.76. And the factor here isn't a percent, it's a time symbol. On the first exam, I will ask you, of course, to make sure that you get the right symbol, if it's a percentage or if it's a multiplier. So in other words, for target for fiscal year 2014, ending on February 1 of this year, they were able to pay their interest expense with the money available to pay the interest expense 3.76 times over. One thing is clear, you do not want that below one because that would mean that you don't have enough money to pay your interest expense and your creditors will now haul you to court. You're in technical default if it's below one. So below one is definitely a no-no. However, so the higher it is above one, the better, not necessarily. Because what you are saying is that they are generating so much money. If, let's say this is like 10, they can pay their interest expense 10 times over. That might signal that this company should borrow more money. It should have more debt in its capital structure. Simply because there are gains to leverage, which I'm going to show you here in a minute. Also, even when it gets too close to one, though, on the downside, even if it gets too close to one, like 1.2, 1.4, that can worry me a little bit there because that means that any flopping of its revenues could push it down below one. Comfort zone, can't tell you, but I would really worry at 1.2, 1. Even 1.5 maybe. Up here at 3.76, it's in a good shape. And it also doesn't look too high. Again, though, if it is way up there 10, 20, 30 times, that kind of tells me this is a company that's avoiding debt when it could get some good out of having a little more debt in its capital structure. So that takes me to the next formula for this one. Debt over total assets, which would tell us the percentage of debt in the capital structure. Balance sheet. Am I having a problem here seeing? Yeah, that really helped. Where's the balance sheet? No, that's not. No. Okay, that's, yeah, balance sheet. Okay. Liabilities. Let's look at its long-term debt and other borrowings. 12,622. For the latest fiscal year end. So we'll put in 12,622, and then we're going to divide that by the total assets, 44,553. And this company comes out to have about a 28.33% debt to total asset. What did I say that was? 28.33% of the total value of the company, total assets, I should say, book assets of the company are debt. The remainder of it would be equity. In other words, in this case, what, about 71.67% is assets. I should say owner's equity. That's capital structure. Is that too high, too low? The lower it is, the more this company avoids debt. The higher it is, the more this company embraces debt. And we're going to get into that discussion of debt in a while. But the idea that debt is an evil is not necessarily true. But you also have to watch out. The more debt you have in your capital structure, the bigger your interest payments are. The bigger your interest payments are, the more you're going to have to sweat it to be able to make those interest payments off EBIT, off operating income. Now let me go to a couple of softer ratios here. A few things, like for example, the dividend payout ratio. And we're going to have to snoop around here a little bit and see if we can find how much they've paid in dividends, Target did, for the last year. Sometimes that's actually a little bit more difficult to see. Dividends declared. Okay, for that year, they did 36, 43, 43, and 43. So that's a $1.29, $1.30. Okay, let me not try to add. I can't add in my head. Times 3 plus 36 cents. So they had $1.65 in dividends per share. So their dividends per share were $1.65 per share. A couple of things we're going to do with this. One is, now let's go back and look at the earnings per share and dig around. They usually have that reported somewhere. Earnings per share. Dig around a little more for it. I hate having to calculate things on my own. EPS. Anyone see the earnings per share? It's usually reported rather quickly. Not seeing it real quick here. You can always just take the number of shares outstanding times the dividend per share, but I'd like to see if I could find just EPS. I thought I saw it here. Bear with me. Let me go back up here. It's interesting because these financial statements can come in different order, and then you're trying to, that's cash flow. Balance, stock, consolidated statements. Well, FML. Well, if you were to see this, then that's odd because I don't even see the income statement that I got a while ago. This one's a rough one because, like I said, they are different orders. Consolidated statement of operations. There. Okay, earnings per share. Whoa, that's rather surprising. Now, basic EPS says take the earnings, the total net income, divided by the number of shares that are outstanding. The diluted says, well, you've got some options and warrants. Probably executives have those. Now, if all of those were exercised, you'd have a little more stock outstanding. So we would divide it by that number to get the fully diluted. Usually, we just look at this number. That's a little surprising to me because we have, for the last year, a total earnings per share. In other words, net income divided by the number of shares outstanding. $3.10. So, the dividend ratio does nothing but take dividend per share divided by earnings per share. And in this case, that would be $1.65 divided by $3.10. That seems awfully weird. I hope that's not right, but we'll go with it for now. But we're going to take $1.65 divided by $3.10, and we're going to get a 53. That's incredible. About, 53.23% of the earnings are pushed back to the shareholders. Now, the shareholders have two things that can be done with that money at the earnings, at the net income line. This company is giving back 53% of every dollar that's available to the shareholders. It's giving it right back to the shareholders. The other way of putting that is what's called the plowback ratio. The plowback ratio is 1 minus the dividend ratio. In other words, in this case, this company is 46.77% of what it earns is plowing back into the company's operations for the shareholders' benefit. Now, as a general rule, the lower the dividend ratio, of course, the higher the plowback ratio, the faster the company is trying to grow using equity. That just seems amazing to me. That's the dividend ratio and the plowback ratio. Again, the higher the plowback ratio, generally speaking, the faster the company is trying to grow. Now, when I did consulting, almost never were these companies were very small. They did not pay a dividend yet. And of course, at the shareholder annual meeting, you get the bitching, well, why haven't we seen any dividends from our common stock? Well, at that point, all your what you have to say is, look, this company is using every dollar that it earns for you at the bottom line, pushing it back into the company to get the company to grow. Eventually, we'll give you a dividend, but not today. And in the case of an older, more mature company, it will be a lot more likely to give a generous dividend than a small company would. So we would see that from this, if this is actually right, and I don't... This company, Target, is seeking to actually not grow through equity funds. At the same time, it's not really doing a lot with its debt funds either. I'm going to show you a few last ratios here. The dividend yield is the dividend per share over the price per share. So let's look at the price per share of Target Corporation. Okay, and I'll just do a... Okay. $63.36. So the annual dividend, $1.65 divided by $63.36. This will come out to be a percentage. What is it?
2.60%.
2.60%. Thank you. The dividend yield, look, capital gains are what you make with the stock price going up or down. Dividend yield, so that's speculative. You don't know whether the price is going to go up or down. You hope it's going to go up, but you really have nothing to do with whether it'll go up or down. So that's speculative. The dividend yield essentially says, if I invest a dollar in Target common stock, I can, at this point in time, expect at least a 2.6% return on my money. That's what that's saying. It's kind of significant to the extent that this is not an absolutely sure thing. Remember, a company doesn't have to give a dividend. It could have been giving a dividend for a long time, and it could stop if it had to. But in a sense, this is a way of thinking, okay, I put $100 into Target. So over a year, the last year or so, that would have been the same, kind of like putting money into a savings account with the expectation of getting out of that a $2.60 check. And if you compared that to what CDs and things like that are paying now, although a common stock is always riskier, it's a pretty darn good thing, 2.6%. It's not a sure thing, but at least over the last year or so, it's been doing maybe something about like that. So it's the sure thing. The capital gain, you know, the money you'll make if the stock price goes up, you don't know one way or the other if that's going to happen. This, you have a little bit more assurance that there's going to be something decent that comes out of this. Where is its dividend? Yeah, because this would be with the most recent earnings statement. And I'm using the last 10Q. I'm glad you pointed that out. In fact, interestingly enough, with that dividend yield, that would tell me that probably with the latest 10Q, they're doing better on net income. That would be my guess. Or their dividend has gone up a little bit, or something like that has happened. So, in a sense, at this point right here in time, with the latest earnings, and I'm using last February 4th earnings, this is actually, you know, for an investment, you'd get this better here than you would putting it into a savings account at a bank. But again, the savings account at the bank will probably be a little bit less risky. Okay, now, let's look at one more. I want to show you one more. This is called the P-E ratio, or the P-to-E ratio, or the price-to-earnings ratio. And all it does is take the price per share divided by the earnings per share. Now, the one that you'll see there on the screen would be the more recent data. I'm going to use the ones off their last financial statement. So the ones off the last 10K, the price per share is $63.36 right now, divided by the earnings per share. What was the EPS on this company? What was it? $3.10. And what you get out of that is $63.36. Let's try turning on. Why does this calculator turn off? Four. Will you let me do it my damn self? What was it? 20.44. Now, what is it right now? It's a little higher now. The deal here is this. The price-earnings ratio essentially says how much is the market willing to pay right now for a dollar of earnings that the shareholder can claim. In another way, you say it like this. The market is assessing a price, which is the expected present value of the expected future cash flows. They are saying that every dollar that belongs to the shareholders right now is going to create $26 by the one right there, $26.72 in value right now for the shareholders as time goes on. So if you think about a dollar, Target's going to put a dollar that it earns for the shareholders into the company's operations. What will that make as far as a present value right now in terms of value to those same shareholders? And right now, the market is saying that it's about $26.72 in value. This is actually a measure of risk. Back in the day, back a long time ago, we got sweaty with P.E. ratios of 10. You know, that's a lot of money you're paying right now for a dollar of earnings right now. 26.72, you're going to pay $26.72 for a dollar that you can have right now in this company. So the higher that is, the more you're willing to throw as a bet on a dollar of the company's earnings that it made for you right now. These numbers can get ridiculous. You can see them up around 100, 200 sometimes. During the heyday of the Nikkei index in Japan, there were price earnings ratios 20,000, paying $20,000 to claim a dollar of income now. I mean, so in other words, the higher this PE ratio is, generally speaking, the riskier this your buy is. Your buy, you're paying 26 bucks betting that a dollar is going to make you that much at least over the life of this company from that dollar that they have that belongs to you. That's what it's saying. It's sort of like a rough, crude measure of risk. And sometimes when portfolio managers are building stock portfolios, they'll pay attention to PE ratios. They'll have a rule, no PE ratios above 30, or no PE ratios below a certain amount. These are some of the things that I wanted to bring up that you want to look at. Dividend yield, if it's zero, that means the company doesn't pay dividend. If you see an NA on PE ratio, that means that the company had negative income at the net line. They won't give you a PE ratio if there's actually negative earnings. And again, I brought up to the idea of market cap. That's the number of shares outstanding times the price per share. That's the market's assessment of the value of the company right now. So, suppose that some company came in and bid, offered to buy Target, let's say for, oh, no, let's do something here. Let me do something here. Sears. Here's Sears. Not paying a dividend. See it? Nothing there. Had negative earnings. The market cap is $2.95 billion right now. Is there any reason why a predator, a black knight, might come in and start a bidding war with a couple of other black knights and white knights, and a white knight? And we would see a final price bought, paid for Sears of $6 million. Is that irrational, or would there be a reason?
$6 billion,
sorry.
Could they try and convince another company that they have a secret to how to make Sears better, and then they're just trying to have another company buy it out so they won't do it?
Could be. That's a very, in other words, there might be hidden value in the company. In other words, the management and board of directors of Sears right now can't see its way out of the hole. But some other company might be able to synergize, bring in new management, bring in new ideas, actually make the stores look like they came out of the 21st century instead of the late 19th century. Something like that. So in other words, that market cap tells you where the company is now and what the expectations are for the company's future. But companies might come in and they would be willing to bid the stock price up, say to $30, $40, $50 a share to take over the company based upon the expectation that they could release hidden value in the company. You are a diamond in the rough. If I leave you the way you are right now and let you proceed with your life, you're going to end up being a manager at Kroger. But if I am able to acquire you, I could put in some cybernetic stuff and maybe fix that neck beard and a few other things. Do you even lift? Oh, sorry. And I could make you into something hugely more valuable than you are now. So, in other words, don't think that 27.40 for the stock price is the end of the story. Look around and look for companies that are possible hostile takeover targets. Another one let's look at in the same industry. Let's try JCPenney. Is that what EY or Is there some reason that sucks? I thought, again, no dividend, earnings are negative. This company is ready to be listed on thatsucks.com. But there's always hope. And you always keep an eye on. If the company isn't dead yet, and let's very quickly, we could see if the company is in real trouble. One thing that we would might want to do is look at the SEC filings for it. Real quick to see how bad our situation is. And we'll do JCP. Oh, well. Why does this suck? It's capital JCP. Are they even trading? These are LLCs. There's no way that's an LLC. JCP receivables, securities. Well, that was a rather disappointing look. JC Penney. It is, I had a bad feeling that was EY. JC Penney. Notice that I've avoided looking at this for a while because it just kind of sad. Well, you know what? Let's try this. Put them together. The hell with it. Let them die. But anyway, the point there being that keep an eye on all of these different measures. Dividend yield, price to earnings ratio, plowback ratio, all of these other ratios. You have to look at them comprehensively. But now, one last little point about this whole thing that I've been doing with you. It's really old school, and computers can do this so fast, we don't even try to do this much ourselves anymore. You can get the ratios very quickly from all these different services. They're all trying to be helpful with this kind of stuff. And this brings us to the difference between what is called technical analysis and fundamental analysis. Technical analysis, what I've been doing. We've been looking at these numbers. We've been turning them around in our head, chewing on them, thinking about what's good, what's bad, and all that kind of stuff. And we call the people who do technical analysis, we even have a charming name for them. We call them elves. The elves have told us this or that about this stock. They've done the number crunching, and the elves say. The other side is the fundamental analysis. Part of it goes behind the numbers and looks at what the numbers are whispering to us. But part of it has really not a whole lot to do with numbers at all. If you took an actual class in investments with me, I would teach you the ratios, teach you how to study stock charts and all that stuff. But then we'd go and we'd actually walk around the stores. We'd actually start trying to call people and get information. We start reading the history, the biographies of the management. We start trying to get rumors from the street about things that are going on. So, for example, if I'm looking at a company like Walmart, look at the numbers. But then you think about other things. Like, for example, they just put a new president of the company in place. Who did they put in? Another Walton. Instead of going outside of the family, instead of breaking the traditions of the family that started it quite well, the question would be, is this company still in need of the Walton family to oversee it? We would go to the stores and we would walk around. We would look at the shelves. How are they doing? Do they have the shelves full? How many different brands do they have? How many people are in the parking lot? What kind of people are in the parking lot? Walk around and look at the, go on maps and say, all right, what's going on around Walmarts? Are other stores starting to cluster? Do they have competitive challengers? Like here in town, just down the street, 5 years ago or so, 6 years ago, a Meijer set up. Didn't really dent the Walmart here in town. But now we have an 800-pound gorilla setting up shop just about a half a mile away. Is that going on other parts of the country? You'd look at the maps and you'd study things and say, oh, suddenly there's a serious competitor. And so all of the Prairie Hillbillies might go to this, I'm sorry, the customers might go to this other store instead of to the Walmart. You look at the press that the company gets. Is this press positive or negative? Does it matter whether it's positive or negative? Sometimes companies deliberately love negative press. You saw Urban Outfitters do it. Another company that loves negative press because it actually boosts their sales is Chick-fil-A. Ever eaten a Chick-fil-A? Chick-fil-A is delicious. The president is a human asshole. And he shows it. He shows his asshole on TV. But that's the kind of customers that go to his store are people who like asshole as well as chicken. Be blunt. Don't be nice to companies. Remember, these companies are falling all over themselves to do what Wall Street boys want them to do. They crawl to them. Look at companies that may be actual winners, but their stock price is low because they don't dance for everything that the Wall Street boys tell them to do. But maybe they have a better idea. So right now the stock price is low because Wall Street isn't buying their stock, but down the road for long-term investment, maybe those companies actually have a better idea than a bunch of suits who never worked a day in their lives in those fancy buildings in New York City. Think about all that. That's fundamental analysis. It's not as easy, but I'll tell you right now, computers can beat your ass at technical analysis every day of the week. Goldman Sachs is now trading in the future. They know what you're going to do before you even do it. So if you're going to win with stocks, you might want to think about fundamental analysis because so far as I've seen, computers still can't think as well as people can. And look at nuances of marketing, behavior, inventory control, those kinds of things. The people side of it. Just the soft side. That's fundamental analysis. So keep in mind that when you go into finance, yeah, we do a lot of numbers. If you take finance course, you major in finance, yeah, we do a lot of numbers. We love numbers. We have boring lives. We don't have sex, okay? But we also do fundamental analysis, too. We ask, what's behind the numbers? What's the story that the numbers just cannot tell us? The world isn't always about numbers. Now, I'm going to take you on to a little another subject here. I'm going to take this off here, kill this board, and turn on the lights again. And I'm going to bring up something I call gains to leverage. Which gets us into risk and return, which we do today and the rest of today and on Wednesday. But this is gains to leverage. I'm going to have to find someone to do this because I'm going to need. Woman, you have spent your whole life in Decatur, but you finally want to break out. You want to live free or die. Strangely enough, this guy's from Decatur too, and he's saying the same thing in his mind. I've got to get out of this place. I want to leave here. I want to invest, make money, and live in a really nice place. So that both of you, not knowing each other, you both decide that you are going to go with an investment. You need a place to live, but you want to live in a nice place. So each of you actually decides to buy a house trailer. That's right, in Pekin. The price is $100,000. This is an incredible deal at that. It's a double wide trailer. It already has Velvet Elvis paintings on the walls. And supposedly in the bathroom, it's kind of small, but there is room for a bidet if you're... Okay. But here's where the similarity between the two of you ends. You are a very prudent, frugal person. You were brought up with the old saying, neither a borrower nor a lender be. So what you are not going to use any debt. You are open to borrowing money. Now, both of you are pretty reasonably sure that this is a really nice place and you can flip this property in a year for $100,000. I'm sorry, for $110,000. But you are going to use all equity to finance it. The $100,000. You are going to borrow on a loan-to-value ratio of $90,000. So your equity contribution is going to be $10,000. So the debt that you take on is zero. And the debt that you take on is $90,000. And the debt is going to be at an interest rate of 6% APR. Let's see what happens to each of you in this. Should be the same. Same investment and everything. But, okay. So in 1 year, you each sell for $100,000. Pay back to bank. For you, there is no payback to the bank. For you, you have to pay $100,000 plus 6% back to the bank, which would be $106,000. You see that? There's going to be $90,000 you have to pay back to the bank plus 6% of $90,000. So that your bill is going to be $90,000, $5,400. For God's sake, someone help me out. $95,400, is that right? That's what you have to pay back to the bank. So, I want you to tell me, how much do you keep? $110,000. $110,000. So you walk around you, on the other hand, you sold for $110,000, but you have to give the bank $95,540. So how much do you keep? What does it come out to be? She sells it for $110,000. Minus, $95,400. $14,600, you're right. $14,600. So... Oops. $14,600. Pretty sucky, isn't it? You get to keep $110,000. You sold for $110,000. You don't owe anyone. You got $100,000. You sorry ass, you all get to keep $14,600. Oh, but wait a minute. There's a problem here. You invested you earned a return on investment of 10%. Well, duh. Yeah, that's kind of obvious. You, the ending amount you get minus the beginning, how much did you invest of your own money? 10,000. Over the original amount you invested. What does that come out to be? $10,014, so that's 4 over. Let me do that just to make sure that I've got this. 14,600 minus 10,000 divided by 10,000. Oh, spank me Jesus. She earned 46%. You see it? That's what we call gains to leverage. The fact that she used OPM, remember what's OPM? Other people's money, means that the little bit that she used got magnified hugely because she paid the bank back a fixed amount. It wasn't based on what happened to the property price. It was just a fixed amount of money. So anything that came on the upside past that fixed was yours. You had no leverage, all your own money. So you got a decent return, but you're saying, well, yeah, but she, yeah, but he has 100. Well, you could do this on 10 properties and trick out. By the end, on 10 properties, you'd have $146,000 with 100%, $100,000. You see the trick? That's what's called creative financing. And there are people who've done it for years. They even run infomercials about it. Just buying lots of properties, borrowing 90% of the money for every one of them, and then just flipping them in a year, improving them, putting a little extra money in. You borrow a little more to make them a little nicer. Take away the smell of the dead bodies in the basement, you know, stuff like that. And at the end of the day, you have this massively higher return. That's why we bitch about companies that don't use debt in their capital structure, because the debt magnifies the equity. That was, 10,000 was your equity. 100,000 was your equity. You magnified your equity like a boss. He, on the other hand, he magnified his like a Pokemon character. Pikachu. Or something like that. Where the hell's my coffee? There is a downside to this, though, of course. The problem is that this is based upon the expectation of the rise in price. If that house price actually fell, your trailer fell in price, you're dead. You're gone. Game over. You just have to keep that double-wide trailer and find yourself a double-wide woman to go with it. Well, good? That's what we mean, though, is first of all, the gains to leverage. Debt allows the company to magnify the shareholders, the owners, the equity holders in return. The ROE will be going up the more debt you use in your capital structure. But the price you pay for that is that you have to pay back the bank that interest expense, so you better hope that you are able to earn enough revenue at the top line so that by the time you get to EBIT, operating income, you can pay that interest. Because if you can't, then the debt holders take over your company and it's over. Nevertheless, though, okay, so two things. Debt magnifies ROE, debt increases risk. And that is where we get to the next, we make that move into risk and return. I got enough for Denny's tonight. Sweet. You have that look of a superhero. No, seriously, look at him. You know, Noob on the outside, Captain America on the inside. Got a dollar. I can show you how we can get up to the roof here, and if you jump off, I'll give you this dollar.
I have a dollar, and I'll give you the same proposition.
You can bite me. Oh, I've done it before. Dude, haven't you seen on YouTube? Professor C jumps off the building.
I'd rather not see you outside of class.
I know, right? You know, especially when I'm wearing those tights and that cape. Oh. It's cool, though. You know, the red. Okay, but where the hell will you focus? Here, a dollar if you jump.
No.
If you get down here and jump, will you? You jump off the roof for a dollar?
A million.
No, this is a dollar.
No, I'll take a million. I'll jump off from the first floor.
No, man. No, first floor you'll bounce. I mean, I want to see a little splat action. Okay. Would you jump from there for a dollar? Okay, you're not going to because I need my dollar for Denny's. Okay, you see, here's the point, though. The greater the risk you bear, the greater the return you must expect. So, and I'm going to modify this rule in the second part of this course, but for right now, the rule is this. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. In other words, at least rational people don't take a risk unless they expect to get something out of it. And if they are going to take a greater risk, they are going to expect something even greater out of it than before. Now, the way we talk about expected return is we talk about it in terms of money. There are people who will take great risks for things that aren't money, but they are still expecting some kind of a return for what they are doing. The movies like Jackass are a great example. People, they don't necessarily get money, but they get credibility for doing the stupid things that they do. So there is always, you don't take a risk unless you expect something out of it. And the more risk you take, the more you are going to expect something out of it. That doesn't mean you're going to get it, because we don't know how the future works. We just don't know. So that's why this word expected is in there, the expected return. So if you speed down the highway, the higher your speed is, the greater the risk is that you are going to get nailed by some cop. But you're doing it for some reason. Maybe you just get the thrill out of seeing stars streaking by you in the sky. Maybe you want to get to your destination more quickly. You're getting some return, expectation of a return for it. But you won't do it for nothing. You are taking an enormous risk being at Illinois State University. You could take a much lower profile risk and work as, I mean, McDonald's is always hiring. You could be there. Low risk, but you won't have the expected return that you would from coming here and getting a higher earnings potential. In fact, you people are so willing to take that risk that you'll even use leverage. A lot of you are using serious leverage, increasing the risk of this. But you are in business, so business classes, you're going for a business major, so clearly you're playing an investment game, a hardcore investment game using OPM to magnify your equity leverage in accomplishing this goal. And I hope it works out, but geez, with me as your professor, God, who knows? Anyway, so there's the first round of it. Risk. Okay. But there's something about risk that I haven't told you yet. There's a hidden word that I didn't describe. (Clears throat) in stock markets and most other markets where there are a lot of players and a lot of action and a lot of information flowing, it's really not about pure risk. Because you can take risks that are just plain stupid to take. And in rational markets, they're not going to pay you for taking a risk that's stupid. They're going to pay you to take a risk that's a real, honest-to-God risk. We see all the time on these financial news networks and these interviews with these incredible fund managers. Well, he earned the best return of all last year. But they never talk about what kind of risk he took. And was the risk that he or she took commensurate with the return that actually came out of it? In some cases, you'll see, yeah, he did a really high return last year, but that SOB took so much risk, it was ridiculous. Way more than he would have even needed to, given the return that he made on it. So we have to look at how risk can be mitigated, how we can diversify it away. And that brings us to the next point about life and death. And I think I already did this one with you, but I want to make sure that we have this clearly in our minds. This is your life. You are a sickly child when you were born per year. You start out life with high medical costs. Fortunately, with modern therapies and a few extra genetic parts we put in to your DNA, you got a little better, had some diarrhea, and then you got a little better, and then you had that psychological program. You tried to kill your sister when you were three. We got you through that. Things get good. Then you're climbing like a boy does, and you fall out of a tree. And unfortunately, the neighbor called the ambulance. We were going to leave you there. And then you have your usual childhood illnesses up and down. And then you get pimples. And you have some other illnesses. And then you get your first sexually transmitted disease. You get into your later teens. Everything's going back good. Then you have that car accident. But you're generally healthier in your early 20s. You ever notice how we all feel? Childhood is, I have memories of barfing my guts out, snot nose. But then you get in your 20s and you start feeling a little healthier. You don't get as many diseases. And everything's going okay. But then you're in your early 30s. You begin to have erectile dysfunction. And then diabetes, more diabetes, more donuts. More diabetes, heart attack, obesity. Cancer. Then you stabilize, but you got all these medicines you take, and you get up to about 65, 68, and then you die, thank God. You were getting expensive. Are we talking motivation? Yep. Okay, now let me track someone else's life here for just a few minutes. Woman, this is your life. Born at the same time, you are really healthy. I mean, geez. Hardly any problems whatsoever. You were feeling great. You know, nice kid. Then you had that manic depressive episode, but everything going okay. And then you had a really bad flu virus, and then you're in your early school years. You have a couple problems. Turns out you can't do ballet. You're really clumsy, but, you know. So we try a few other things. Gymnastics doesn't work out at all. 2 years in a body cast, yeah. And then you get your first very bad boyfriend. And then you get out of that. You go to college. You're doing okay. But then you're okay. But the problem with people, we live longer now than we used to. And one of the problems with living longer is that we get to see diseases we hardly ever used to see. In men, high blood pressure, diabetes. In women, cancers like breast cancer. Those are cancers that are actually a bad sign that we are living longer. We are living long enough for these diseases to show up in us. Cancers that we just didn't see in the 1800s because people weren't around, lived that long. We have better sanitation and hygiene and all that kind of stuff. So we see more cancers. We see more high blood pressure, diabetes, problems like that. In your case, real big swelling of the legs. Well, I mean big swelling of the legs. Then you try in your early 60s to get a tummy tuck. That went really bad. And you live a lot longer than the guy does, but you're constantly more meds, more of that. And finally, in your 80s, you die. Here's the key, though. Those two people don't have perfectly correlated illnesses. Their spikes happen at different times and in different shapes, different lengths. If I were to put hundreds and then thousands of people of all the same age, I would see a smooth path of growing problems. But then if I add in people of younger ages to this risk pool, their paths would be different. And then if I were to bring in even more generations, their paths would be different. Lower at first when the others were higher. So that over a large risk pool of people of different ages, different ethnicities, different genders, different, well, there's two, okay, three, if you, Lady Gaga. But what would happen is if you get enough people together, you see something wonderful happen. It's almost completely predictable how much the entire pool will cost per year. And it's pretty level. That is the power of insurance, is that essentially the risk pool flattens out, smooths out all of the variation because the correlation, they're not all perfectly correlated in time or in circumstance. So over a large group of people, we can get rid of most of the risk. In other words, the volatility. So an insurance company is not facing the volatility of your illnesses and the unpredictability. We are facing the smoothed out risk volatility of a bunch of people, including your sickly ass and a lot of other people's. That is what is the basis of risk diversification. Now, there's still going to be risk. Don't get me wrong. There will still be blips from year to year. You'll never get rid of all of them. And more importantly, there will still be a cost from year to year. But that is also that phenomenon of nature is behind investing in stocks. We'll get to that in our next class. I thank you.